Sure, there's fruit juice, coffee, and tea, but plants have so much more to offer when it comes to beverages that help shape our lives. The Lloyd Library and Museum is celebrating that connection this winter with an exhibition called The Botany of Beverages. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss some of the exhibition's highlights are founder of Kentucky Botanical Company and the Green Door, Christian Perry Watt, Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, and exhibit curator, Patrick Ford. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Patrick, there was a time in human history before beverages, right? I mean, when we were just consuming what was available. So how did we gradually create these beverages that we drink today, and what were their original purposes?
You're right. To the dawn of human history, we were drinking water and milk, of course, in various forms. And beside those beverages, and the most artificial among them, all beverages come from plants. And it often is a kind of a tangle between health and flavor, medicine and pleasure. The history of beverages is based on that, essentially. And a lot of times the medicine is sort of cut off. They're like, what's this bitter tasting thing? And if we just remove that, it tastes great. But that was the medicine part of it, right? So no, going all the way back to kind of the first infusion of an herb or a root or something like that into water, we have what we call a beverage, right? And so yeah, the exhibit really explores since the kind of dawn of human history. We go back all the way to kind of about 7,000 BCE in discussions of like the first kind of wines. And then we learn all the histories of all the great beverages out there that are plant-based.
Ah, well, I know one plant-based beverage that everybody loves is coffee. And the plant that produces coffee beans has been wildly successful because humans want to drink it. Can you talk to us a little bit about our relationship with coffee?
I know that it's only second to oil in the world's largest traded commodity.
Wow.
So that's something I learned. That's what's kind of cool, just being a librarian and curator. Much like a journalist, you become sort of a temporary expert on these things. So that's a big one I learned. I guess it's the most third most consumed beverage worldwide beside water and tea, coffee. And I think it's just that invigoration we get. There's something to it as well. I don't know about you, but most people, it's... when you're young, you don't love it. It's a bit of an acquired taste. It's related to adulthood and feeling grown up a little bit and liking something that's a little bit more complex. And a lot of people maybe don't like it when they're younger, but you have that sort of perfect pour over for the first time and you're like, oh, this is something else, right? It's kind of like having Patron or something for the first time and you're like, oh, tequila's great. It's the same sort of notion. So we're just sort of really drawn to coffee, I think, through because of its invigorating effects. Like so many beverages, it's about socialization. It just creates a space all of a sudden. You're just sharing this and you're going to probably talk and chat. Same with tea. But yeah, we're exploring the good and the bad of coffee over the years. You know, there's a lot of negativity attached towards how we got all this wonderful coffee. And as there are with so many plants, and we can't help but explore that at the Lloyd in all of our exhibits.
Corey, in general, is it a good thing for plants when people get that interested in them, or is it a bad thing for plants?
I think it's a great thing for plants. Because one of the things that people tend to do is we tend to be more connected to animals. We tend to be drawn to, you know, they move around and do things. And I think we often forget the critical role that plants play. And just, you know, they make our food and our air that we're breathing. And so for me, this entire exhibit, it's really sort of part and parcel with the sexy side of plants, because it's trying to show your average person that plants are much more interesting and they have these hidden lives and this value that I would like people to appreciate. As a conservationist, I think that's really important that people value these systems. And if we're going to do that, I think it starts with people learning and appreciating the uniqueness of plants, both what they give us in terms of beverages and food, but then also valuing them sort of intrinsically just for the sake of the plant itself.
Yeah. Kristen, I know you're really going to focus in a talk later this month in January on alcohol-free plant-based mm-hmm. drinks, kind of sober botany. What are some of the ways, going back a bit, that herbs and roots and flowers have been used in drinks historically? They haven't always been about the buzz of tequila, right?
Absolutely. I think that a really important herb that we could talk about when it comes to that is kava. Kava is a really cool, relaxing root herb that's been used ceremonially in Fiji and Polynesia for thousands of years. And you know, it's probably something that we stumbled upon accidentally, and it became ingrained in the culture. Much like coffee or tea, it's about the ritual, and it is about the energy that can be created when you consume different herbs, different plants with friends. I think that the intrigue of alcohol is also as much about that energy and that connection. And you can absolutely find a replacement for it, because it's really about creating dopamine, creating community, and doing that with something a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, Patrick, we've talked about tea a little bit in passing, but how did tea become such a big deal for people? It's played a really important role in international politics, even over the centuries.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was mostly in China for centuries and centuries. It was sort of their secret, their own element of ritual and culture that they kept to themselves. There's a lot of debate about when tea starts. Apparently, it could be as early as 2700 BCE. That's the sort of legend that some leaves fell into the emperor's cup and he drank it and it tasted very good. But the oldest archaeological evidence for tea is about 300 BCE, but I'm sure it existed before that. It doesn't really make it to Japan even until 800 of the Kamrin era. It doesn't make that leap from China to Japan. So that was a really interesting fact. And it doesn't even make it to the Indian subcontinent until the 1830s. And that's through, as you were suggesting, there's a lot of problematic history related to beverages. And that's because of the British are kind of forcing tea, and they knew it would be cheaper if they had it down in India and they could take control of tea. So it was sort of a Chinese secret for a really long time, but it explodes. I think the same way coffee did. People in the West just get sort of enamored of things in the East. And it was kind of a hip thing for, you know, rich and cultured people to have drank first chocolate. Chocolate actually kind of predates tea and coffee in popularity in Europe. That was another thing that was shocking to find out. But it's sort of like with a new thing from the new world that was chocolate, like especially drank as hot chocolate. They would call it milk chocolate back then.
Yeah. We're talking in this recorded interview about the important links between plants and beverages and an exhibition at the Lloyd Library and Museum that explores those connections. Well, Corey, we wouldn't have any of this. Tea wouldn't have gone anywhere. Coffee wouldn't have gone anywhere if it weren't for plant reproduction. I'm trying to find a polite way to talk about this.
You can say we that works.
Okay.
Flowers, we can say.
Oh, that's a nice, that's the flower power. That's right. But that's not always as simple as like the birds and the bees, right?
It isn't. It is not. Like I was saying before, I think it's interesting when you can make parallels between plant reproduction and animal reproduction, because we don't think of plants as having sexual reproduction. And in fact, early on, Linnaeus, when he's classifying plants, how he's going to name them, he did it according to the sexual organs and how these plants were reproducing. And there was a lot of pushback, both within and outside of the church, people going as far as saying that, you know, onions don't do that. They're not amoral like that. And so it was this pushback that how could we say that plants are going to be sexually reproducing? But what's interesting is we still don't know a lot about the fundamentals of plant reproduction. And yet plants are doing things like tricking pollinators into pollinating them without nectar.
Now so, tell us more about that.
Well, orchids. So for example, all orchids, about 40% of them are liars. They are faking
pretty,
having
pretty
nectar.
Liars.
They're pretty, pretty beautiful liars. Many orchids, but there's a few in particular that I will talk about during my talk is the flowers look almost identical to a female bee. And they obviously need to put a lot of energy into making these flowers that look like a female bee, but then they're also saving lots of energy by not producing nectar. So male bees are flying by and they might be looking for nectar from other flowers, but they see this female bee and they're going to mate with the female bee. And in doing so, they wind up pollinating the flower. So that's just one example of how plants have cheated the system. They have evolved these different adaptations to avoid having to produce nectar and lose those resources, and at the same time still have their eggs fertilized with pollen. And so I think revealing that for people really opens us up to this whole new world of plants. And I think it helps us connect better with plants, because otherwise they just become a green wall and it's hard to tell one from another. But when you look at a bee orchid and you see what it's doing and you think, wow, that is, wait, what did you just say? it gives you pause, I think.
Yeah. Well, and aren't there some plants that can become kind of male or female depending on the circumstances?
There is. A lot of people locally will know of Jack in the Pulpit. It's a native wildflower. And most plants are both male and female, but there's a few, less than 10% of plants can be, you'll have a male tree and a female tree. Maples, for example, you have a male maple and a female maple. Well,
and when they love each other very much,
then they may start a family.
Yeah.
And some plants, like the Jack in the Pulpit, depending on the resources, depending on temperature, you may have a plant that changes from a female plant that would produce ovules to a male plant that's producing pollen. Because producing a fruit, producing an ovule, an egg, is so much more energetically costly than producing sperm or pollen, which they're synonymous, right? And when you are in a situation where the soil might have low fertility, it might be a bad year precipitation-wise, just change from female to male, save all those resources, and still have your DNA represented the next generation. So you will have plants that are changing from male to female and potentially back again.
Wow. Okay. I want to come back to you, Christian. I know you're going to be talking about sober botanicals, these non-alcoholic beverages, these alcohol-free kind of elixirs and things. Mm-hmm. Do those have almost an anti-stigma? I mean, are there people who are like, nope, if I'm going to drink it, I want something that gives me the full whammy? Or are those really becoming more attractive to people because they want to be a little healthier and avoid the effects of alcohol and that sort of thing?
I think that they are absolutely becoming more popular. Trends show that less people are drinking alcohol, particularly younger generations. And we're still curious, though. You still want to find something that can help regulate your nervous system. You want to find something that you can sip on and it enhances energy levels so that you can be more social. And those things can be found in so many different options. I think that there is still a lot of unknowns. And so that's what we're here to do, is help educate people and take them, you know, down a road of what lion's mane can do well for you, how the kava plant can make you feel. Because there are so many options that can do those things, like help regulate your nervous system, be really good for brain health without leaving you intoxicated, hungover the next day. And I think that particularly in the last 2 years, there's actually been a huge swing to people who are either abstaining. You know, we're in the middle of dry January right now. So abstaining for even a weekend, taking a break, drinking less, or just giving it up completely.
Huh. Kristen just mentioned dry January. I'm going to go back into the liquor, Patrick. Talk with us about the history of herbal liqueurs. Did many of those start off as medicines too? I mean, at least in name, or were they all about the fun?
Absolutely. They had medicinal roots, and they link back to the ancient world. They are the closest modern descendants of ancient medicinal drinks. And like I was saying before, this kind of mixture of medicine and pleasure. Even in, you know, ancient Egypt, they were brewing beer, and then they were putting herbs and such and roots and all sorts of things that we could, that I'm sure Christian could illuminate for us, into their beer for medicinal purposes. And they're kind of just adding this and that, spices and such, to make it taste better. So it's, again, it's that kind of butting up against each other, health and pleasure. And so, yeah, I think it's just a sort of consistent integration of sort of medicine into flavored products. So kind of like taking wine and enhancing it with whatever is kind of nearby. It kind of became codified. Don't get me wrong, there are many herbal liqueurs that have that boast hundreds of different herbs in them, but most famously, there's a lot of wormwood in there. This gentian is very common. Gentian is the main ingredient in bitters, for example. It's this bitter herb. So like Angostura and Peychaud's, it's made from gentian. And also Moxie Cola, if anyone knows that they're archaic soda brands, that's from the northern New England and Maine. Moxie, it's quite similar to Coca-Cola or root beer, and it was popular in its day in pharmacies, but that's made from gentian. So yeah, all these sort of things, citrus, cinnamon, clove, star anise, very popular ingredients. And many of those things have medicinal benefits, often digestive health, I think, was the number one. There's often kind of invigorating in one way or the other, but often helping people digest better is the reason that these were added to these drinks.
Another plant-based beverage that I think a lot of people around here are fond of is bourbon. So plants are at the core of whiskey and bourbon. Patrick, what's at the root of those distilling traditions? How did that get started?
Well, bourbon is, especially is connected with corn. And I think that's the major distinction that it has from the other famous type of whiskey, which is scotch, which is primarily barley. And I know that to create proper bourbon, it has to be 51% or more corn-based. It doesn't technically have to be grown in Kentucky or Tennessee either, I found out. But one thing I'd learned was that so much of the ingredients of whiskeys that are native to Kentucky are actually grown in greater Kentucky. You would think that corn being such a massive plant in the U.S. that it could come from everywhere. Don't get me wrong, there are whiskeys that have corn from anywhere USA, but I found it really particularly heartening, I guess, to see so many local Kentucky, and we're across the border. I live in Kentucky, so I just think of Cincinnati in terms of Kentucky, right? But that's something I found was exciting. And a lot of smaller artisanal brands, but even big ones like Maker's Mark are touting their use of local and regional ingredients in their bourbon. So that was an exciting kind of thing to learn. And so, yeah, it was just fun to come across all these books with these, you know, gorgeous illustrations of corn and barley. It's just like our and wheat. And it was our rare opportunity, this exhibit, to kind of make barley sexy.
What's so interesting about that is when I think about corn, which is sort of a Northwestern North American native, but wild corn looks nothing like the corn that we see in the grocery store. And so it's a good example of how, because we liked eating it and drinking it, we have changed this plant. I mean, absolutely changed it from its wild type. So you have this crop that for all intents and purposes is nothing like it originally was, but yet it's been successful because of how much people liked it and spread its genes. And so now you have all these different types, and it's just a really interesting sort of back and forth. It's not just us using it for the drink, but it's actually changing the very essence of what the plant is.
Well, the fact that people can do that and that plants can do that. Like, you know, you were talking about orchids and their little fake lady bees and how different plants and trees can change their sex. Corey, does that mean our plants just a lot more complicated than we give them credit for? I mean, I think a lot of us just think of them as these, like you said, kind of green wallpaper.
Yes. Just before I came here today, actually, I was reading a really interesting article. There is still a debate, and I'm not, most people will probably know which side I fall on, but there's still a debate about just how, let's say, conscious plants are. So I don't think plants are out plotting our demise or anything. They're not necessarily logical, but we aren't sure about those, the hidden, again, I'll say neurology. I'm going to say it not quite meaning neurology, but the sentience of plants. How do plants detect what's around them? How are they interacting with their environment? Because we know that they are interacting with the other plants and animals around them. We know that they respond to stimuli. We know that they make decisions. We know they have memory. And yet we're still resistant to extend this idea of consciousness to them. And again, I'm not I'm not quite there myself, but I think there's so much that we don't know about plants that when I can highlight some of the hidden lives, I love that look on someone's face when they realize, oh my gosh, I didn't know plants did that.
Yeah. My husband's always joking about our corn overlords and how we'll all have to, you know, pay tribute at some point because of what we've done to corn. So maybe I think he'd be on board with you. Kristen, Corey's been telling us how these plants figure out ways to get together, so to speak. You referenced this earlier. These botanical beverages really bring people together too, right? How important is that in the way you look at beverages and the role that plants play?
I think that's everything. Obviously, I truly believe that plants have so many health benefits, and that's truly why I started into this industry that I'm in. But I think that we all need social connection right now, and historically, plants have been doing that. You know, you can think about all kinds of different ceremonies for ancient cultures have been using plants to come together. And I think it's so important that we can still do that, that they can bring each other together, create that sense of community. You can socialize around them. And they're warming too. You know, you have something like the cacao plant. You know, it's a very heartwarming option that really opens people up in the same way perhaps that alcohol would to reduce social inhibitions and things like that. There are truly so many plant options out there that can do the exact same thing for people.
Well, this has been fascinating. I've been talking with founder of Kentucky Botanical Company and the Green Door, Kristen Perry Watt, Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, and Lloyd Library and Museum Exhibit Librarian and Curator, Patrick Ford. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
The Botany of Beverages exhibition continues through April 24th with a program on sober botanicals later this month and a talk about the sexy side of plants in February. You can find a link with more information on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu, and Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.